Hi, this is Susie Larson, and thank you so much for listening to Live the Promise today. Our website is filled with even more powerful and encouraging interviews. Learn more by logging on to myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening today. I'm Susie Larson. Glad to have you joining me for the second hour of Live the Promise. Well, Ann Graham Lotz just joined me first hour to talk about reading the signs of the times and knowing what the Bible says, not only about Jesus' return, but about our faith and about walking in the Spirit. You can find that whole powerful conversation up on podcast form on our website, myfaithradio.com. Okay, now we're going to switch gears and talk about how to steward our power well. Have you ever thought of that? This will be a very interesting conversation, and I'm very eager for you to hear it. Just a couple reminders real quick first. I would love for you to remember yourself and think of yourself as a radio missionary. Go to our website. We've got so many articles and podcasts there that are so shareable, share-worthy, myfaithradio.com. I mean, I'm thinking of a couple conversations I had just last week, one with Kay Wilsweima about our OCD disorder, which she calls obsessive comparison disorder. Go check it out, because we do fall into that sin of comparison so easily. She was funny, she was winsome, and she had a lot of great things to say. Be a radio missionary. With a click of a button, you can send it out by Facebook, email, or Twitter. Also, remember this, that our Faith Radio Writers Contest is about ready to wrap up. We'll take submissions until May 17th. That's this Sunday. The theme is grace. We want to hear your story. And if you've got a dream to be a published author, now's the time. Take this opportunity. Don't let it pass you by. All the information, the guidelines, and the rules are up on our website, myfaithradio.com. Once you launch your submission, once you send it in, then people get to vote. So use your sphere of influence, send that link out, and we will judge by how many people vote for you. And we'll take it from there. And six of you will come in studio to meet with editors from Bethany House Publishers. Don't miss the opportunity. Again, the information is on our website at myfaithradio.com. I can't wait to tell you about my guest, and we'll get this conversation started. Andy Crouch is executive editor of Christianity Today. His books include Playing God and Culture Making. His articles have appeared in numerous publications, including Wall Street Journal, and in several editions of Best Christian Writing and Best Spiritual Writing. You can find him online at andy-crouch.com. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Susie. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, we're excited to talk about your brand new book, and we love to start out talking scripture, and you chose a passage. I'm wondering if you have it in front of you, or would you like me to read it first? I would so love for you to read it, but if you don't have it in front of you, I can.
I do.
Oh,
I do,
yeah.
And it ends with the last part of what I'll read is maybe one of the most surprising things a first century rabbi could do. John 13, 1 through 5. I'll read that far at least, then we can talk about it. But now, before the festival of the Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The devil had already put it into the heart of Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, to betray him. And during supper, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, got up from the table, took off his outer robe, and tied a towel around himself. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was tied around him.
Amazing,
John 13,
isn't it?
1 through 5.
Talk about that passage. It's startling, isn't it?
It would have been utterly startling for these disciples to have their master and teacher get up from the table and do this thing that just was the least dignified thing you could possibly do. And normally all this foot washing would have been taken care of before the meal, and no one would have commented on it. It would have been done usually by a servant or a slave at the beginning of the meal, and you wouldn't comment on it any more than you would at a contemporary dinner party if someone got up to go to the bathroom. You know, no one remarks on it. It's just, it happens out of sight. It's done as quickly and obtrusively as possible. And here's Jesus in the middle of the meal, the most powerful person in the room. And I love how John says, knowing where he had come from and where he was going, he chooses to wash their feet. It's quite an extraordinary moment. And of course, what happens next, as you know, is Peter is very upset at the idea that Jesus is about to do this. But it was what Jesus had come to do.
And he says, you know, unless I wash your feet, you have no part with me.
Yeah. as if to say, this is a new reality, Peter, and if you don't let me do this, you don't really understand what my kingdom is about.
That's right.
That might be at least part of what he means by that.
Mm, so good. Well, Andy, talk about what prompted you to address the issue of power. And I even like how you mentioned, I think it was in the introduction, that some said, can't you pick a different word, like leadership, influence? And you're like, nope, I like the electric word power.
Yeah, I thought, you know, part of what I thought we needed, maybe especially in the church, more broadly probably in our culture, was an honest and hopeful conversation about power, both honest and hopeful, because I find it's hard to be honest about the reality of power in many human communities, especially in churches, actually. And, you know, one of the realities of power is some people have more and some have less at different times and in different ways. And that's a hard thing to be honest about. And then when you're honest about it, it's hard to have hope about it, that that could actually lead to good results and to flourishing. You can probably guess what most people say to me when they learn that I'm writing a book about power. They quote a 19th century figure named Lord Acton, and they say, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And if there's one thing everyone knows about power, it's that little phrase. But here we have Jesus, who has absolute power and yet is not corrupted by it, and he's kind of teaching his disciples how they're going to be able to have his spirit in them, living in them, with his power with them, without being corrupted by power.
You know, it is just mind-boggling. There's parts of this we will not get until we see him face-to-face, but just even learning that humility really wasn't considered a virtue until Jesus modeled it. I mean, ego,
yes.
Egomanism, you know, was what
yes.
really was esteemed, is that the greater the ego, the more powerful you were. And yet, I mean, he turned the world on its heels. And as I was preparing for today's show, I was thinking of two instances where his power just struck me. And I want to just kind of speak to him and have you speak to him. But then I would love to know if there's others in his story that stand out to you. But one is a power displayed and the other is a power restrained. So in the Gospel of John, Roman soldiers and Jewish leaders, they come to arrest Jesus. They're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. When he says, I am he, just the virtue of the power that exudes from him, they all fall backwards. I mean, speak to that power displayed without him even trying, you know?
Right. You know, Jesus, at many points in the Gospels, people remark in different ways. This was a person who carried himself with authority, not like the scribes, Mark says. In that moment, we see, you know, he's not arrested because of a failing of his own power. John, especially, of all the Gospel writers, makes this really clear. Jesus says to Pilate, I have the power to lay down my life and take it up again. You know, when Pilate thinks he's in charge, Jesus is saying, no, I have access to power you can't imagine. And John gives us these glimpses to remind us that at no point is Jesus just kind of swept along by
exactly.
events.
Well, interesting. You must have just knew where I was going, because then that was the next example of power restrained, where Pilate's like, you don't speak to me? Don't you know I have the authority to crucify you? That struck me with the first time I ever read that many years ago. You have no authority over me unless it was given to you from above. So power restrained is another aspect of power, because he could, but he didn't.
You know, I was thinking also in your opening story, I love that phrase, harnessed power. I think that's was that the harnessed?
I was talking humility is just harnessed power. Yeah.
Harnessed power, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of this word that Jesus uses in the Sermon on the Mount in the Beatitudes, blessed are the meek. And that word meek, which in Greek is praus, was often used of tamed horses. So a horse in that context, and still today, is an incredibly powerful creature. But when it's been tamed, that power is harnessed, literally, right, in the case of a horse. And Jesus had that ability to restrain his power. And I also love what he says to Pilate, you know, whatever power you have has been given to you.
Yeah.
And that's one of the kind of key themes that emerged for me as I wrote this book, is that power really is a gift. It is not something we possess. It's not something we can generate ourselves. It all comes ultimately as a gift from God. And it's when we stop seeing our power as a gift that actually we become very dangerous.
Indeed. In fact, you think about anybody with any kind of power influence is at least tempted at some point to use that to their benefit in a way that makes people pay. And you go back to that Philippians passage that he did not consider equality with God something to leverage to make us pay so he could benefit.
Wow.
He did the opposite, right?
Yes. I think this is one of the best kind of tests of any power that I may have. I have power as an editor, as a writer. I have power as a father, as a husband. And the question always is, who is flourishing because I have power?
Mm.
Am I flourishing, or am I using my power for others flourishing? And when I start to use my power mostly to secure my own benefit, my own flourishing, then I'm not following in the way of Jesus, who
wow.
just consistently flourishing flowed out of him rather than flowing to him, or him kind of amassing or accumulating benefits from it.
So good. I just want to revisit that. Who is flourishing because I have power? Boy, we need to all ask ourselves that. So are there other parts of Jesus' story that jump out to you? When I'm talking power restrained and power displayed. What
yeah.
about you when you think of his example? Any others jump out at you?
You know, one, I just got to retell this story. I was actually at a high school, a somewhat church-related high school, but many of the students were not Christians. And I got to tell this story that clearly many of them had never heard, that comes out of the Gospel of Mark, of the synagogue ruler Jairus, whose daughter is very ill. Jairus is probably, could be the most prominent man in town, certainly the most prominent Jewish man in town. And he comes to Jesus to ask Jesus to come and heal his daughter. And you'll remember the story, and
yeah.
probably your listeners will, but it was amazing to tell this story with kids who had, some of them had never heard it. And talk about, of course, there's this huge crowd, because when a very prominent rabbi and a very prominent leader have a big crisis, everyone wants to see what's going to happen. And in the middle of that crowd is a woman who has been ill for 12 years, which is the same age as Jairus' daughter, by the way.
Yeah.
She comes up behind him and thinks, if I can just touch him, I'll be healed. Touch his cloak. And she is healed. And here's the word, Jesus, knowing that power had gone out of him, stops and says, who touched me? And, you know, we know this story, but it's so stunning that on the way to heal the daughter of the most prominent and powerful person in town, Jesus stops to meet and get to know perhaps the least powerful person in town. And one of the things that I think comes out of this story is that Jesus does not care about status. He doesn't care about rank. All he cares about, in a way, is daughters and sons.
Oh,
he calls the woman daughter when he sends her off. Daughter, your faith has saved you. And then he goes to Jairus' house, and of course they say, well, it's too late. Why trouble the teacher? He says, no. She's just sleeping, which is not true.
Mm-hmm.
And here's Jesus restraining his power in a sense. He could do this incredible miracle out in public, but instead he gives the impression, no, she's just asleep. I'll go in and wake her up. And so when he goes in and uses his power to heal and lifts up that daughter, that's done secretly while the other daughter who met him in the crowd is healed publicly. Everything gets turned kind of topsy-turvy when Jesus uses his power, but what does always happen is people come away healed and their lives transformed, and they flourish because they were known by him and met him.
How beautiful. Well, I know I'm going to get this quote wrong, and I can't remember even who said it. It was some 17th century saint, I think, but he said something like, I sought the Lord, and a dove came near. I sought the dove, and he flew away. And in other words, the point was that I sought the Lord, and the sense of his presence and influence came near. But when I sought the experience, I lost the sense of both. And
wow.
it's like that with power, isn't it?
Yes. That's very interesting. Yes. When we start to seek it for itself, I think that is that's a mistake. Because, you know, the truth is, I think most of us, our problem is actually, at least secretly, that we have more power than we know what to do with, because we're image bearers of God. You know, we are created in his image. If we are followers of Christ, we're filled with his spirit. And trying to just sort of accumulate or build up enough power to get something done in the world. I think often we think, if I had more, I could really do something valuable. But Jesus' way is the opposite. Jesus was very willing to sort of release power, didn't grasp power, and that's a much safer posture, I think.
You are amazing, more than amazing.
Job or field you go into, you view it as a mission field, and I think that that's what most of the people I've seen who are in power, especially government, which is where I came from, I think that's how they viewed it. And I had one boss in particular who always said we should conduct ourselves in such a way that whatever we do, we wouldn't mind if the whole world were watching. And I think that was one way of sort of witnessing and saying to people, this is how a Christian conducts themselves.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and we're talking with Andy Crouch about how to view power and authority. Andy, I know there are many people who truly believe that power of any sort is evil, and if someone gets a lot of power, it's almost righteous to dismantle it because it'll corrupt them and become a bad thing. I think Chuck Swindoll even said that they'll cheer you to the top, but when you get to the top, they'll shoot you down. Say a word for us, if you would, because I know that's not right thinking. There's a righteous way to handle power, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, I think that we've inherited a couple things. We've inherited from our world a couple of misconceptions. One is that we often think that if I have more power, someone else must have less. That is, it's what we sometimes call a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose. If you win, I lose. And we think that we have to sort of win every game, and that if we win all the games, we'll have all the power. Now, that can be true of certain kinds of power, but the deepest kinds of power, the ability to actually create something new in the world or in a situation, is not zero sum. There are actually ways to use my power that everybody benefits, everybody flourishes, no one loses. And when we look at power that way, it's a much more hopeful thing than if we think, well, as soon as I'm, you know, winning this little game, then others are losing. And this relates to the other thing that I think we think power always comes with, which is what I would call status or privilege. And that's the quest to be kind of ranked highly in a community, in a church, in a business. And I think the pursuit of status is very dangerous, because the truth is, when you're at the top of an organization or the top of that ladder, you actually may be more constrained in your ability to really do good than people who don't bear the burdens of that position. So I don't think high status is ever to be sought. It's not necessarily something to be just thrown away, but it's never something to build your life around, because actually if you get in that high position, you'll find all kinds of limitations on yourself that you didn't know were there.
Great insight. Well, you also wrote that in order to understand the good news about power, we first need to understand the old news about the distortion of power. I'd love for you to unpack that statement.
Right. So, you know, something has gone wrong in this story, and I think it's the very heart of the story, really, is that our forebears, the first man and the first woman in Genesis 3, they seek power independently of God. And one way to put it that I'm finding very helpful is that all true power comes with both authority and vulnerability. Both authority and vulnerability go together in Jesus, and I think in any healthy exercise of power. And the first man and woman in that garden, they are both they've been given dominion over the world, and so they have tremendous authority, but they're also naked, which is very vulnerable. And they're naked, not ashamed of it, but they're still vulnerable to one another and to the world. Well, the serpent kind of teases them and tempts them with this idea that they could have all authority and no vulnerability. In other words, you will be like God, knowing good and evil. That's tons of authority. And you shall not surely die. In other words, you're not vulnerable and dependent on God the way you think you are. And that human quest to have authority apart from God and authority apart from vulnerability is really at the root of the two things the Bible says has really deeply gone wrong in the world, which is idolatry, the worship of things that promise us authority without vulnerability, and injustice, actually taking positions in people's lives where we get all the benefits, all the authority, and they are reduced to only vulnerability.
You even say every idol intimates that life apart from God is within reach, within our grasp, available for our control. All you have to do is look around at our marketing and even as we as Christians, what we fall into, we share the same addictions, the same striving, the same rat race pace. And maybe what do you have for an answer for that person listening who's like, well, you got me. I'm bound in the same ways and bought into that same lie.
Yeah, we have to somehow we are all enslaved by this. Every single person is. And this is the point, right, of Paul in Romans 7, so in the first person says, I find myself enslaved to these things. There's a couple ways I think that freedom comes. And, of course, one is worship, worship of the true God, in which we acknowledge our dependence on him and we taste and see that he's good. And that can give us a kind of distance from these idols. You know, once you've really seen how good God is, the advertisements are just a little absurd.
Exactly.
there's a rental car company that shows this guy like sort of I don't think he's literally flying through an airport, but, you know, he's like walking, striding confidently. Everything parts in front of him. He walks up to the counter. The woman is there smiling. She already has the car keys for him. And what it is a fantasy of godlikeness. It says, I can just live this unencumbered life. I'm never going to be interrupted by anyone. Everyone will serve me. It's so blatant. But once you've gotten to know the true God, you watch an ad like that, and you're like, oh, that's crazy.
Absolutely.
That's so small an ambition, right? For me, a rental car. but I think worship is an antidote. And the other one I talk about in the book is Sabbath, rest. The true God is unlike every idol. There's no ancient Near Eastern God or any modern addiction that gives you a day off a week.
Yes, exactly. My husband has a Calvin Miller quote on his desk. Lord, help me to remember that I can make more bricks in 6 days than I can in seven.
Wow.
Isn't that great?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And no idol and no agent of injustice ever said to any person, take a day off. And God says that every single week, that we're to rest and enjoy and recreate. And I think that's an essential kind of antidote to the 24/7 addictions we're all surrounded by.
Well, we need to be taking a break in just a moment. So on the other side, I do want to talk about when it really moves it, when power, misuse of power goes into injustice. But and you even talk about how powerlessness can be a gift because our limits can be a gift. I have so many questions for you, Andy. But before we take a break, say a little bit more about Sabbath, because I think that's one of the most underrated disciplines, rest. And to me, rest is an act of faith. And so say more about that.
Absolutely. I spent 10 years, my first 10 years of kind of my adult life working with college students. And those of us who are out of college know that you have more free time in college than you will ever have probably the rest of your life, except maybe when you were a three-year-old or something. But what I found is that college students could not believe it was possible to take a day off a week from studying, even though they had so much flexibility in their schedules. And that is when I really started to realize this is not just it's not just a little difficult to do. It is actually, it strikes at the idolatries of our culture, which say I've always got to be productive, I've always got to be busy, and I won't be able to succeed if I rest. And that is such a lie.
And you know the other lie in there, Andy, is I'm far more important than I think I am.
Yes, exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
More rests on his shoulders than ours, and so we can get over ourselves a little bit, right? So, talking to Andy Crouch, you've got 4 copies of this beautiful hardcover book. I'm only going to open the phones right after the break, so I want to give Andy as much time as possible. So if you've got a question about redeeming the gift of power, we'd love to talk with you. 877-933-2484. Again, 877-933-2484. Or you can email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. When we come back, more from Andy Crouch, author of the book Playing God, Redeeming the Gift of Power. We'll be right back.
So many times we talk about power as it relates to those we are in authority over. And what I've learned through Scripture is that Jesus never exercised power over people. He used his power to come up under people and support them in a way that made them better people.
For tuning in, I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, having a great talk with Andy Crouch today. He's got an amazing new book out titled Playing God, Redeeming the Gift of Power. And I'm just saying, Andy, it's pretty gutsy to tackle a topic like power, and you did it beautifully. So appreciate so much the book.
Thanks. It was scary because, you know, I think often people don't want to talk about it, to be honest. So I was wondering, will anyone want to read this book? But I'm finding the right readers are finding it, and it's pretty encouraging.
No, it's such an important word for our day. Let's talk for a moment about powerlessness. And there's two different aspects, especially that you address. One is that powerlessness can be a gift. And I mean, I'm thinking initially just that my limits do create a certain dependence on God. But say more about that.
Well, I think that's the very heart of the matter, that when I run into my own limits, the things that I don't have power over, I am much more likely to seek to depend on God and sometimes on other people in a healthy way, ideally. And it's when we have the fantasy that we can control everything in our environment, that we have no need for God in our environment, that we're actually the greatest danger to ourselves and others. So powerlessness, to the extent that it's an experience, just the human experience, that there are all these things I care deeply about that I cannot control, actually allows us to seek out relationship with God who is in control, and the God who, of course, is willing to grant a great deal of freedom to his own creatures.
Isn't that just amazing when you think about it?
Yeah.
You know, often when I'm speaking and I talk about when we come to the edges of our limits, we don't like it, so we medicate, we eat, we buy, or we join another committee to just make up for the where we lack. But don't you think we short-circuit our spiritual growth? Because I feel like when you come to your limits, you can get, it's an opportunity to experience more of God, right?
Yeah, you know, that's a very striking thing that we kind of replace. When we come up against those limits, we have these replacement behaviors.
Yeah.
And part of it is that we're experiencing our vulnerability, and so we go for a quick hit of authority. You know, we think that, you know, if I can buy something, if I can purchase something or consume something, that will give me back my sense of authority. And in fact, true life and true power are both authority and vulnerability. Mm. And this is true even for God. You know, I asked some friends just a few days ago, do you think it was vulnerable for God to create the world? And in one sense, that's a very odd thing to say of the all-powerful God who made the world. Could that have been vulnerable for him? And yet, of course, in the most strict sense, it absolutely was, because it introduced at the climax of creation these creatures who had the freedom to deny him and turn away from him and ultimately crucify the Son. And so God became woundable. You know, vulnerable just means capable of being wounded. So even for God, that vulnerability is part of what it is to be a full being. And so it's going to be that way for us, too.
Wow. You know, when Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom, I'd read that one of the translations of that poor in spirit means blessed are those who know their need. So when we come to a place where suddenly we know our need and we can humbly respond to it the way he intended, there's more growth to be had, but how often we miss it. And you even think, I mean, I don't know if this is true, you would be able to correct me on this, but I'd heard that Hitler was slighted by a Jewish girl in his teens, and so he turned it around and had a chip on his shoulder. But how often you see that with people who have any kind of influence, where they can, you know, if they're slighted in any way, rather than coming to the edge of their need and humbly getting what they need from God, they react in a godless way, and we see it, don't we?
Yes, or you might say they react in a very godful way, but not the true God. They start playing a false God. You know, I've come to the conclusion we're all playing God somehow.
Yeah.
And we're either playing the true God, the one who made us and gives us the image of how to play in the world well, or we're playing a false God, which ultimately is very destructive.
And, you know, and sometimes that's such an important point right there. But, you know, even sometimes people are playing God and they don't think they have a wicked motivation, just a need to control. Like, for instance, Steve Jobs, I thought it was so interesting. I did not know, you wrote about him in the book, that he had this obsession with food as if to control his destiny and his health. Say a little bit about that, because here again, he's playing God with his health in a way, isn't he?
It's an incredible story, and we really, the general public didn't know it until Walter Isaacson, the biographer of Steve Jobs, wrote about it after Jobs' death. But, you know, Steve Jobs, from his teenage years, had a kind of obsession with controlling his diet. And Isaacson, his biographer, says he had an eating disorder. And an eating disorder is just another way of saying an idolatry of food, using food as your God, and using food kind of to become God-like, to have this kind of mastery over your life. And the tragic thing is that when, in 2003, Jobs' doctors discovered that he had what's called islet cell pancreatic cancer, which is actually highly curable with a pretty simple procedure, Jobs refused to have the procedure for a year almost. He tried to treat his cancer with raw diets that were not had no effect at all, and actually weakened him. And then by the time he agreed to have the procedure, the cancer had spread. And in a very real way, that idol of control through food took his life prematurely and robbed the world of an image bearer, you know, who was a creative, not just a creative genius, but unleashed creativity in others. But idols want to undercut that. Idols are in the world, and we believe there are demonic realities behind this to undermine image bearing and to introduce these false images in the world that can't save you. And Steve Jobs, at the crucial moment in his life, turned to that thing he had always hoped would save him and give him mastery, and it failed him.
Such an amazing story. So how would a person listening today identify an idol in their life? So they're a Christ follower, but there's something that has a hold on them. What are maybe some questions they can ask themselves?
You know, I think a very good diagnostic technique for this is two of the classic, well, you can actually do all three of the classic spiritual disciplines: solitude, silence, and fasting. So we're thinking especially about solitude and silence. When you get alone and you're quiet, you don't have the radio on. Every afternoon you're listening to this program, but
except for that,
there's a season also to turn everything off. Yeah. No phones, no little screens glowing at you. The question I would ask is, what hopes and what fears kind of well up from your inner life? What fantasies and what anxieties? And you will quickly discover, if you sit even for 15 minutes quietly, honestly, you'll discover what you're driven by, both the things you're drawn to, those are your hopes and your fantasies, but also the things that you are really deeply worried or fearful of. And I think those are almost always clues to whatever our own particular idols are, the things we crave to give us that sense of authority without vulnerability.
And it's so good to identify them, because we are worshiping them by our very actions of bowing down or making rules around and making accommodations for. That's why I love your antidote is worship God. That's a great place to start, because he's God Most High. And, you know, when you think, oh, magnify the Lord with me, it's like, putting him in his rightful place, you know?
Yeah.
Love that.
And then we are in our rightful place,
exactly,
too. And it's not because the true power of the true God is not zero sum. For me to magnify God, far from meaning that I diminish or somehow get smaller and less consequential, actually it elevates my own dignity. And this is why the psalmist who walks out under the stars and says, you know, oh God, when I consider your heavens, the work of your hands, who are we that you're even mindful of us? Then in the very next verse says, but you've made us a little lower than the angels, crowned us with glory and honor. So it's this beautiful economy in which my magnifying God and placing myself under the worship of God actually raises me up rather than coming at my expense.
Oh, so, so beautiful. It's so good to just pause and consider his greatness and his patience. And I say this on the show all the time, that I marvel that we get to be a work in progress. You know, I always liken us to toddlers carrying a family heirloom. I'm like, really? I can't even believe we get to carry this treasure in these earthen vessels. You know, we get it wrong. We take the credit at times, but he sends new mercies because we need them. I marvel at that. But all right. Well, Andy, let's talk about powerlessness that results from an exercise of power that has a devastating impact on the world. And you and I share a passion. We've talked about slavery and trafficking and issues like that on the show many times. But for those maybe who've tuned in and not heard those past conversations, talk about powerlessness because someone else is exerting an evil stance with their power.
Yeah, well, we've talked some about idolatry, but the other thing that the prophets just consistently say God hates is injustice. Yeah. And the essence of injustice is that some person or sometimes group of people seeks to have all authority and no vulnerability, and they do so at the expense of other people. And, of course, the most dramatic form of this throughout history and today is actually slavery, literal slavery. There are between perhaps 21 and 30 million people today who are forced to work, cannot leave, and are not paid. That's the essence of the international definition of slavery. And in every case, there's a God player, not playing the true God, mind you, but someone who is extracting and exploiting other human beings, other image bearers, to get the goods that they want, but with no benefit returned of any kind, no wages, no freedom to the people who serve them. And they're able to do it because they can get away with it, basically. And while that's the most extreme form of injustice, unfortunately, probably all of us at some point have been under the thumb of someone who used us for their ends rather than kind of treating us with the dignity that we deserved. And unfortunately, many of us, sometimes even without knowing it, have played God in other people's lives that way as well.
And that's why it's so important to ask the question you suggested at the beginning of the conversation: who's flourishing because I have power? This is Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. More with Andy Crouch in just a moment.
My chains are gone. I've been set free. My God, my Savior has ransomed me. And like a flood, His mercy rains. Unending love, amazing grace.
It means to not only that you have that power or that hold on something in our own culture or our own world, but you also have this ability to change things for the better. And God's utilizing you in amazing ways that not a lot of people get a chance to utilize. So when you have a position of power, you're actually using those gifts that God has given you to glorify Him and allow people to see Him through you.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. We're talking with Andy Crouch about how to view power and authority. Andy, you had an encounter with some former slaves in India and a man named Jayakumar who was giving them counsel on how to live in freedom.
It was such an amazing moment. Jayakumar is the head of World Vision India, and we visited this village where when World Vision started working there, about 80% of the children, if I remember the number correctly, were in these situations of slavery. And now it was down to like 10%. So we were with these kids who probably themselves had been in what in India is called bonded labor. It's basically just modern-day slavery. And for Jayakumar to say to them, when you grow up, remember your parents, remember God, remember your community, I think in a deep sense what he was doing there was restoring what injustice had broken. Because all misuses of power break relationship. They break relationship with our families. They break relationship with the true God in whose image we're made. And they shatter communities. Because what community is safe when children can be enslaved in its midst? And because Jayakumar didn't say, when you grow up, just get out of here and go somewhere safer, but instead said, no, I want you to remember this place, and I want you to honor your parents, he was actually knitting back together what a multi-generational history of injustice had done its best to undo and unravel. I thought that was an amazing intervention, and I'll never forget the expressions on the kids' faces as they listened to him and heard these incredibly restorative words for their own community and their own lives.
And wasn't it one of the, I don't remember if it was a child that had been in a community of slavery, to go back and confronts one of the slave owners, what you're doing is illegal, and you said, yeah, you had to do a double take. Wait a minute, you what?
I talked with a couple 12-year-old girls. My daughter is just a year older than that right now, and they had been in bonded labor, and they were now free. And they, when I asked them what they did after school, they said, we free slaves. And I said, well, what in the world do you mean? And what they meant is they would go to the few places where children still were in this situation, and they would confront the people who were keeping them, and then they would go to the child and say, you don't have to stay here. You're free to come with us to school tomorrow. We'll find you a uniform. And I realized I just met, you know, my first 12-year-old abolitionist.
There you go.
And I told Jayakumar about this conversation, and he said, that's what we're going for at World Vision. He said, I'm so glad they said we free slaves and not World Vision free slaves. Because the danger is, in any kind of charity or development work, that actually we can end up playing God in the lives of the poor. And, you know, we could end up just replacing a set of very malevolent, dangerous God players with a kinder, gentler set, but what wouldn't change is that the poor themselves don't see themselves as agents of their own flourishing and as people who have something to contribute to the world. And so he was so thrilled that these girls saw themselves as the ones who were really changing their own community.
It's just so amazing. Remember Gary Haugen, president of IJM, who endorsed your book, by the way, but he said bullies, he says they might be mean, but they're not brave. And you just need to find someone who's braver than them. And to think about a 12-year-old girl,
right?
Kind of amazing, really.
Yes, there was this simple, unforced bravery of someone who herself had been rescued and now was being taught, you know, who she really was in the sight of God. It was so beautiful.
And that, you know, scripture is just so, you just read it with justice in mind. I mean, God honors so much that person being a voice for the voiceless. And, you know, one more thing about slavery before we move on that I just marvel about is these slave owners so often, they you know, employ a false debt. It might even have been a legitimate, but a lot of times it isn't. But they keep the slave believing you have a debt that you can never repay. And that to me, Andy, is so demonic because it's so opposite of God's kingdom, right? I mean,
yes. Yes. Oh, exactly. And the truth is, in these situations, the money lenders, so-called, do not actually want the debt to be repaid because they want the labor. They want they don't just want some money. They want a human being who they can command at will and exploit in whatever way they will. So they create all kinds of pretexts to keep the debt from ever being repaid, and usually the debt accumulates even while the child is working for them. And it's such a picture. This is, you know, I think the reason God hates idolatry and injustice is actually because ultimately they're the same thing. Idols ultimately demand everything from us without delivering anything. And the perpetrators of injustice do the same thing. And God hates this because it is not the flourishing for which the world was meant.
Yeah,
and
it
distorts his image. And that's why the prophets, you know, can just turn on a dime from what we would think of as religious issues, idolatry, and then political issues, you know, misuse of labor and so forth. But to God, it's all the same. It's an abuse of the ones that are made in his image and who he wants to flourish.
You know, you think about righteousness and justice are the foundations of his throne. Just pause on that for a moment, that he makes us right, and then he empowers us to do right. I mean, because that's who he is, and that's his heart for the world. And And because there's been power, a misuse of power, I think so many can miss God. Because people in authority over them, maybe even a parent, the way the parent has said, you'll never amount to anything, it's hard for them to break loose and break free and get a fresh perspective of God. What do you say to maybe that adult listening who only heard condemning words growing up?
Well, this is really what has gone wrong in the world, is all the images we see now of what God is like, they're not the true images we were meant to see, and none of us play the true God all the time, you know. My own children have grown up with me as their father. I think they're surviving so far, but I definitely have not perfectly imaged God. And this is why, you know, I think worship can be tremendously helpful, but there's also, I don't know, in my own life, I found tremendously helpful having a few friends who could pray with me through those points of pain and disappointment in my life where significant people in my life had not imaged God at a crucial moment. And I was relatively fortunate. You know, I haven't suffered kind of direct abuse like other friends have and many people have. But all of us have had God imaged badly in our lives at some point. And the wonderful news is Jesus is so ready to heal that and steps in so quickly when you bring those things in prayer in a trusted community. It can be with a counselor, with a pastor, or with friends, and Jesus is ready to kind of heal those false images and grant you a true image. And that's what had happened even in that community, you know, that I visited in India, where there had been an amazing amount of healing when you consider that slavery had gone on generation after generation, but they were able to break that cycle as Christians just patiently served there and bore witness to the true image.
So good. Talk about the disciples, if you would, for a moment, and how they matured and grew with regards to power, because there was some grasping, you know, at first, and then there was walking in a kind of humble, holy confidence that was just downright amazing. So just talk about how they evolved that way.
Wow. It is amazing, isn't it? I mean, the disciples, especially early on are just so clueless about what they're getting themselves into. And you know, in many ways, it comes to a climax when I love how Matthew shows us it's actually James and John's mother who comes to Jesus. Not the last time a Jewish mother would kind of seek out benefits mm-hmm. for her kids, right, or any kind of mother. And the mother comes and she says, oh, grant that my children, my sons will sit on your right hand and your left. What she's asking for, of course, is status. And Jesus responds, he doesn't even answer her request directly, but he asks a question instead about real power. He says, are you able, that is, do you have the power, to drink the cup that I'm going to be drink and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? And they, again, having no idea what they're saying, say, Lord, we're able.
sure, whatever fact, that means.
In my church growing up, in the Methodist church, we had this wonderful hymn that quoted the disciples. It was called, Lord, We Are Able, but it misquoted them because it sang, we sang those words as if they were just happy, yes, hey, here we are, we're ready to go. Whereas, in fact, in the Gospels, it's clear they really don't know. When they say we are able, they don't know. And Jesus says, you are able, and you will drink this. But, oh my goodness, as for sitting on my right or my left, I don't even know. That's not even my business. It's the Father's job. In other words, he's concerned that they be fashioned into him, his image, bear the world's suffering in a similar way to the way that he will, in a definitive way on the cross. And he's not concerned at all about status. And when you think about it, all the times the disciples try to rebuke Jesus, Peter tries to rebuke him, are when they think that he's got this power thing totally wrong. and Jesus has to say, no, you don't understand what I'm about. On the other side, of course, of the crucifixion and resurrection, two things happened, I think. I think the disciples saw Jesus' vulnerability on the cross and saw how deep the vulnerability of God himself goes to the world. And they became capable of that kind of vulnerability so that almost all of the 12, except perhaps for John, indeed were eventually martyred, were killed for their faith. On the other hand, at Pentecost, they received incredible authority they didn't have before. So they ended up with a kind of Christ-like authority and vulnerability. Whereas before the cross, resurrection, ascension, and Pentecost, I think the disciples were just bumbling around, trying to figure out how to make it happen on their own, and not aware of really how much power was available to them.
You know, that's such a great synopsis. And I think about, you know, when they were looking at the disciples, they're like, what are you looking at us for? Something happened where there was power with humility. And yeah. Just say a word about that, Andy, because, you know, someone can even start out with the best of intentions, and it can go to their head if they yeah. get promoted, so to speak, too fast.
Yep.
But I think a great mark of power is that Jesus is lifted up. It's not false humility, but a true, to the tips of my toes, I know this isn't me, this is him. Say something about that.
You know, I think about this a lot. This year I took a new job as executive editor at Christianity Today, which is, you know, within our organization and to some extent in the broader world, a position of more power than I've had in the past. And I've thought a lot about this question. How do I hold this in such a way that it does not end up actually corrupting me and making me all too used to the sound of my own voice and to people deferring to me? And I think that two things, at least, that have to happen are that I have to become even more deeply committed to other people's flourishing. So I just have to wake up every day thinking about how do I use whatever power I've been given or position so that other people flourish. And I need to create the kind of environment, even among my own team that I lead along with my colleagues, to make sure that people can be honest and say, hey, we're not flourishing here. And then the other thing is, I think with greater authority, you have to also develop greater vulnerability. So more openness to suffering, more honesty about your own limits. And it's when people develop more authority without developing more vulnerability that things start to go off the rails. The problem is we often want that from our leaders. We actually would like our leaders to just show us a way to be authoritative without being vulnerable because we'd all love to believe we're part of that kind of story. So we can make idols of our leaders. And that's, I think, one of the very seductive things is you can start playing a part that other people want you to play when, in fact, you are still just one ordinary human being trying to serve God And you can't allow people to sort of push you into that role of really an idol that promises authority without vulnerability.
Boy, Andy, so good. I pray you'll come back and talk more about this topic because I feel like we just scratched the surface.
Thank you, Susie. Thank you so much for the wonderful conversation about this.
Well, I loved it. And God bless you and congrats on the great book.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. You can find a podcast of this program up on our website at myfaithradio.com, along with podcasts from Austin Hill in the Morning, Connecting Faith, and our weekend programs. Be sure to share this conversation with a friend who would be strengthened by it today. You can do that by clicking the share button under the audio link. Take some time to browse our website as well for new articles and content about growing in your faith in Jesus Christ. Finally, guess what? The Lord wants you to last long and finish strong. He's the one who'll keep you strong to the end. Have a great day.